yeah, when you think of Attila the Hun and then later Genghis Khan,
yeah,
they were not good people. The two men, you have the Hun and the Pope, Mano y Popo, and they have a conversation. You to another edition of the Uncensored Pilgrims. I'm Marty McLean, along with the irrepressible
Paul Price.
Paul Price. Now, Paul, you have a haircut.
Yeah, I got a coupon.
Every time Paul gets a haircut, I say, "Man, I like your hair." He says, "I got a coupon in the mail."
Yeah, yeah, great clips. They're great. They send you out a coupon in the mail, or as some people say, a coupon.
Coupon. You know, I go to Great Clips, but they never send me a coupon.
You must not be...
I'm not a preferred customer.
You must not be preferred.
Yeah. Or is yours like one of these things, we haven't seen you in so long, please come back?
It's probably because I only go about twice a year. Two or three times a year at the most.
Well, your hair's looking really good, stylish.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do they trim your mustache?
No.
They don't do the mustache?
No.
Okay. You know, I don't know why, but half of my eyebrows are gone. They just are. And I went somewhere one day not too long ago, and I got my hair cut, and she said, "Do you want me to trim your eyebrows?" And all I could think was, "Are you blind?"
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if she says this to all of her customers. I'm thinking, I'm here with half eyebrows, and you want to trim what I've got left? But anyway, that has nothing to do with the 5th and 6th century of church history, and that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at the 400s and the 500s. Which would be the 5th and 6th century of
churches. I wonder what was in fashion in the 5th and 6th century. Did men, were they clean shaven or did they have a beard? I don't even know people looked like back then.
You know, I don't see a lot of... Maybe
Constantine was, you know, when you see Constantine, the bust of Constantine, yeah, he's clean shaven.
Well, maybe they
But all the emperors were, weren't like
I don't remember a lot of facial hair.
Yeah, I think all the Roman emperors were clean shaven that I've ever seen. So,
but they weren't clean cut.
Maybe not.
No. They do look like... Maybe it was harder when you did a statue to make the facial hair.
Well, I bet it was harder to represent that, but I don't know.
Well, they wouldn't have to worry about me if they made a statue of me, because I can't hardly grow any facial hair anyway, so it would be a moot point. Okay, the 5th or 6th century of Christianity, the fall of Rome. Now, that is the event that would shake the Western world, the fall of Rome. This was the eternal city. And when something's called the Eternal City, you don't really think about it going down.
Calling any city the Eternal City other than
Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem.
The New Jerusalem, that is kind of like calling a ship unsinkable, right?
Yeah, like the old Titanic.
Yeah, you're just asking for trouble there.
Well, here's what happened. In the 5th century, we see the fall of the once great Roman Empire. As the empire begins to unravel, and there's many reasons why, we'll briefly look at those in just a little bit, church leaders actually started to assume a greater role in societal leadership. But what you had is the Huns coming from the east, and they were, you know, rape, pillaging, and plundering. They were, you know, just sacking all the civilizations along the way. And so that caused the barbarians to want to come down south into the Roman Empire. So if that just kind of tells you how bad the Huns were, if the barbarians were running from the Huns, had to be, you know, pretty bad folks. But what was happening is this migration had a very unsettling effect upon the Roman Empire. And eventually, at the end of the century, the empire would basically be conquered by the Goths, the Franks, the Vandals, and the Lombards. But you had the pressure, first of all, being put upon these barbaric tribes to the north, and to the east, the pressure was put on them by the Huns as they were coming in, and it was very unsettling to the empire. The barbarians had to seek safety from the Huns, and they started filtering into the empire. They actually got permission to cross the Danube River and come into the Roman Empire.
Now, the Huns were coming out of, like, weren't they coming out of like the Mongolian steppes type of area?
Yes, it's from the north and from the east.
So very similar to later on, you would get
the Mongols.
The Mongols, yes. The Genghis Khan and the Mongols.
Yes,
the Huns were like a related group just earlier on, weren't they?
I think so. Yes. So they
that group of people, they just They just like to sweep around and take everybody over, don't they?
Yeah, when you think of Attila the Hun and then later Genghis Khan,
yeah,
they were not good people. They just weren't. But you have them coming down, and they're forcing the barbarian tribes to come filtering into the Roman Empire. And what they did is they got permission. The Romans said, okay, come on over. And it started being a whole bunch of them coming over into the empire. And they try to keep them in a certain area. And the food and supplies that they were supposed to supply for these folks really didn't get through a lot of times. And they were starving. And it is said that a lot of them, the Visigoths, they had to sell their children into slavery in order to be able to have dog meat.
Ooh.
So you can imagine the ill will and the feelings that you would have between the empire and the barbaric tribes to the north as they're filtering down. Now, it did lead to some battles, some Gothic wars from 376 to 382 that actually, I think, killed a Roman emperor during this time. Mm-hmm. But there's one guy, his name was Alaric. He was a Goth, a Visigoth, and he had asked for gold, silver, pepper, and farmland. But the emperor had told him no, so you know what he did? He just came on down Italy and he came to Rome. And in 410 AD, Alaric and his barbarian hordes, they show up at Rome and they ransack the city for 3 days.
Wow.
They breach the walls, they come into Rome, and Rome falls. The city itself is penetrated.
Yes.
And this had such a devastating effect, even the church leaders of Rome, he would say, quote, my voice sticks in my throat. The city that shook, that took the whole world captive is itself taken captive. So 410 AD is the first time the city of Rome is penetrated, the walls are breached, the barbarians come inside, but they leave after 3 days. All right. Now, fast forward to 452 AD, and we're going to go back and fill in some of this history. But Attila the Hun, he's entered Italy. He's on the brink of taking Rome. He is referred to as, quote, the scourge of God. That's how bad he was. The emperor sends out a delegation to negotiate peace with him at the Po River. And Attila really wants nothing to do with the delegation. But the bishop of Rome is with him, and he catches Attila's eye. And so Attila wants to talk with Leo.
Yeah.
Leo is the bishop of Rome. I mean, look to Leo as the first pope as far as, you know, actually having that position and exercising that power in some ways. The two men, you have the Hun and the Pope, Mano e Popo, they have a conversation. And at the conclusion of that conversation, Attila agrees not to attack Rome.
Okay.
I mean, he's at the edge of Rome. He's going to, you know, rape, pillage, plunder. We're going to burn the place. But Leo talks to him man to man, and not only does Attila agree not to attack Rome, he actually leaves Italy.
Do we have any idea what might have been said?
You know, there's a lot of conjecture. I don't know what, you know, exactly what was said, but here's what we do know for some of the motivations. Historians, here's what they suggest. They suggest that Attila was looking for a way out. He was looking for a reason to retreat. His army had been suffering from an epidemic. His men were at the point of mutiny. So this, with the Pope, that gave him a good out. And it wasn't too long after that, he retreats in what we know, I reckon, is today Hungary, the center of his power. And he,
so that's why it's called Hungary, because yes, they're Huns, right, basically.
And he chokes on his own vomit and blood, I think.
Oh.
It was on his wedding night, if I read correctly.
Attila?
Yeah, Attila.
So was he just overindulging on his wedding night?
Wouldn't you think Attila the Hun would be prone to over...
You would think.
Yes. So yeah, obviously things got a little out of hand for him, and he died.
You know, that's a lot of ancient warlords died that way. At least, well, I don't know about a lot. I'm aware of at least one other famous example. You know who I'm thinking of?
Tell me.
Alexander the Great. He died of partying too hard.
Yeah, well, one time he was partying too hard and he killed one of his friends, didn't he?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I do know he died of it.
Died of it. So, yeah. So if you are a somebody that's going to go around and conquer other nations and all, yeah, you probably need to not party too hard.
Yeah, but then they would say, well, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point?
What's the point? Well, that's what happened with Attila in 452. Now, in 455 AD, just 3 years later, the Vandals show up. Gesseric, he's the king of the Vandals. He shows up at the footsteps of Rome. He is there to rape, pillage, and plunder. The city's in a panic. The army's in disarray. The emperor tries to flee, And an angry mob sees the emperor trying to leave, and so they get him and they kill him. So you don't have an emperor. You have an army that's totally unorganized and looking to leave the place. The Vandals are at the gate. A dead emperor, a non-functioning army. So who are you going to call?
Let me guess, the Pope.
Pope Leo. So what happens if Pope Leo goes out and he engages in conversation and negotiations with Gesseric, who's the king of the Vandals, but to no avail. But when Gesseric is riding away, having had his conversation with the Pope, he yells over his shoulder, 14 days looting.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not going to rape, not going to burn, he's not going to massacre.
Yeah.
They're just going to loot for 14 days. So Rome had no other choice. They opened the gates, and they let the Vandals in, and they vandalized the place, literally.
Yes.
And they took the wealth of Rome, and they took a few prisoners, but then they left. So once again, Leo saves the day.
Saves the day again.
So you can see how the power of the Pope and the prestige of the Pope, of Leo, the Bishop of Rome, how he is growing in power because the emperor, I mean, he's dead. Nobody else can have an audience with Attila.
Yeah.
But for some reason, within the short span of about 3 years, he's able to deal with Attila the Hun and Gesseric, the king of the Vandals.
Yeah.
And save Rome. Well, it finally happens in 476 AD. The barbarian Odoacer defeats an anemic Roman army and he displaces the final Roman emperor, whose name was Romulus Augustulus. And instead of being called emperor, he was called king of the Romans. The emperor in the east, remember you have a divided empire now, the eastern empire with the emperor and the western with an emperor. But the eastern emperor, Zeno, acknowledges Odoacer as the king, and he's willing to be the viceroy of the emperor from the east. The one in the west is willing to be the lesser emperor, which actually is just a king now.
Yeah.
So it is said that at the end of the 5th century, as it came to a close, that the western part of the empire had been entirely overrun by the barbarians. But here's the caveat, okay? Here's, if you want to see a little, let me say a little silver lining. Many of the barbarians were actually Aryan Christians.
Okay.
But they didn't know much about the faith. They were,
and just for everybody listening, just to clarify, we're saying Aryan in the sense of followers
not
of
racial.
Arius.
Right.
Not in the, you know,
German, Hitler
not in
sense.
The Hitler ethnic sense, but no. in the theological sense, Aryan.
They believe that Jesus was a created being
yeah.
and not a member of the Trinity, which was erroneous. But anyway, but they were easily converted to Catholic or Nicene Christianity. Historian Robert Baker, here's what he says about it, quote, "The Aryan Christians among the tribes were unskilled in doctrinal matters, and they were easily won to the Orthodox point of view in the person of Christ."
If only that were still true today.
Yeah. But see, they wanted to learn. They were easily convinced, well, Christ is, Jesus is a member of the Trinity. He's
yeah.
you know, eternal. And they were like, okay, well yes.
Yeah.
And so now all of a sudden all these barbarian hordes that are invading Rome, they're actually changing from being Aryan to being Nicene.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal. Now there's one guy I want to talk about before we talk about St. Augustine. And his name is Eusebius Hieronymus Sophronius. But he was affectionately known as Jerome.
Jerome.
Did you know, how do you get the name of Jerome from that?
I don't know. No, I don't see the connection there, Eusebius.
His name could be Henry or Butch, but it's Jerome.
Yeah, I'm more familiar with the Jerome from Seinfeld.
Jerome from Seinfeld. Anyway, this Jerome, he lives from 342 to 420. He's the guy that translates the Old Testament, New Testament. He translates it into the Latin version of the Bible called the Vulgate. And one of the things he did is, especially with the Old Testament, instead of going from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew, he goes back to the Hebrew.
Right.
Now, not everybody liked what he did, but his translation of the Bible, as far as in Roman Catholic churches, it was, you know, very, yeah. it was the standard
he
for
went to the
hundreds of years.
He moved us from the Septuagint to the Masoretic text.
Okay.
Right? And see, I think that's a... There's both good and bad parts to that.
Okay.
So, because there are some of those places in the Masoretic, like we've talked about before, where It looks like they've been mishandled by the Masoretes, and they've kind of obscured the Messianic. Some of the Messianic prophecies are obscured in the Masoretic text, where they're, and even, you know, the New Testament sometimes quotes some of these prophecies, and when you read it in the Septuagint, it reads the same as how it is quoted in the New Testament.
Right.
But then if you read it in the Masoretic text, it's totally different.
Huh.
So in some ways, it wasn't all good that he did that. I also believe, if I'm not mistaken, Jerome, and I would agree with him on this, Jerome did not want to see the Apocrypha included.
Yeah.
But I believe the Pope forced him to include them, so he put them off on their in their own section separately,
okay,
as opposed to just mixed all in with the other books,
right?
Because he did not believe the Apocrypha were, you know, inspired. So.
Okay. Well, here's the thing: it took him 23 years, and he finished it in 405 A.D. And one of the things about Jerome, which I found to be kind of intriguing, I don't know if intriguing is the word, but interesting, is that he quit taking baths. He said, quote, "He who has bathed in Christ has no need of a second bath."
Well,
so he quit he quit washing them. And then he taught these two women, Paula and Marcella, that he lived with. It was you know, platonic, trust me. And they were also studied scriptures and everything. But he taught them, they didn't bathe either. And he talked about Paula. This was kind of a compliment to her piety. He said, quote, "She was squalid with dirt."
That's almost as bad as what Origen did. Thinking, taking the literal, taking the
castration
literally.
I think so. What you can see in the early church, some of these guys, they got very quite literal with some stuff.
Very literal, sometimes to a fault, apparently, and.
But Jerome, he translated the Bible. He probably didn't have the best social life. I mean, if you're not going to bathe, you're just not going to hang out with folks all the time.
I mean, it's weird because, you know, even Jesus washes the feet of the disciples. I mean,
and you would think that
why wash? I mean, that just doesn't make sense. Yeah. So,
well, that's Jerome. Now we're going to talk about Saint Augustine, who lived from 354 to 430.
Okay.
Now, Saint Augustine, he's one of the biggies.
Yes.
I mean, if you want to, you know, he's one of the biggies. He's
one of the most influential guys in church history.
Yes, and continues to be influential.
Oh, yeah.
He was born in what we know in North Africa today as a nation of Algeria. That's kind of the area he was born in. His father was a pagan. His mother, Monica, was a Christian.
Now, wasn't it called Hippo at that time?
Yes, we're gonna get to that in just a little bit. As a young man, he fell in love with a woman and had an illegitimate son, and he named him Diodatus. They were together for 13 years, and initially, Augustine followed the teachings of Manichaeism.
Yes.
Did I nail that, Paul?
Yeah, Manichaeism.
It taught that Jesus was spiritual and had no material body. I know there's a lot of other things that's associated with that.
It's kind of a Gnostic offshoot of Zoroastrianism, the Persian religion.
Yes.
And it's a dualistic cult that teaches an eternal evil god coexists with an eternal good god. They're in an eternal conflict, kind of like the, you know, the yin and the yang kind of thing.
Wow. That was influential in his life. It had no effect upon his morals, should I say. In 384 A.D., he moves to Rome and becomes a professor at the University of Milan. At this point, he leaves his mistress that he's been with for 13 years and has a baby with, and he becomes engaged to a very wealthy young lady. But at the same time, he comes under the influence of Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan. But the thing about St. Augustine is that he was driven by an ungovernable sexual passion. And years later, he wrote about his sexual passion that he was just governed by, that he was driven by. He said, quote, "The evil that was in me was foul, but I loved it."
Okay.
So his soul was vexed as he learned from the bishop. And one day when he's walking in the garden, he hears a child's voice saying, "Take it and read it." He picks up a New Testament and he turns to Romans 13:13 through 14, which says, quote, "Not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envy, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. And from this is what Augustine says about this passage. He says, quote, instantly as I reached the end of the sentence, it was as if the light of peace was poured into my heart, and all the shades of doubt faded away.
Now, okay.
He believes at that time he is converted. And on Easter 387 A.D., Augustine and his son are baptized by Ambrose of Milan.
Yeah.
So shortly thereafter, he returns to North Africa with his mother and his son. But his mother dies shortly thereafter, and then a year later, his son dies. So he loses his mom and his son within a very short period
yeah.
of time.
Yeah, and I think if you, as I understand it, he writes a lot about this stuff in his autobiography, The Confessions.
Right.
Confessions of Augustine. And I think what you find, one of the things that drove him was this philosophical thing, which we today call the problem of evil.
Yep.
He was searching for an answer to that. That's actually what got him into the cult of Manichaeism to begin with. He was looking for an answer
to... So it predates his conversion.
Yeah, yeah. This philosophical issue predates his conversion because he wants to know, how is it possible that we live in a world of both good and evil? How can evil coexist with good in the same world?
Yeah.
And the Manichaean cult gave an answer that satisfied him initially, you know, which was that, well, it's because you have two different gods, a good and an evil god, and they're fighting each other. But then ultimately that didn't satisfy him, and it was Ambrose who was able to provide the true Christian answer.
Yeah.
And then he would later expound upon that and explain that evil doesn't exist in and of itself. Evil only exists as a perversion of something that is good. Huh. Just like cold doesn't exist. What cold is an absence of heat, right? So you take away all the heat out of a room and you have a cold room.
Yeah.
But the cold isn't a thing that you can put into a room.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And in the same way, evil isn't a thing that you can put somewhere or even a thing that you can create. It's a perversion or a lack of a good thing that should be there that isn't there.
Yeah.
That's what he explained.
Okay.
So I think that's a good explanation.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like he's a thoughtful guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, in 390, he is ordained as a priest. In 395 A.D., he's made the bishop of Hippo in North Africa. Now, when Rome fell in 410 A.D., everyone was shaken to the core. A lot of the people fled Rome, and they came to North Africa. So he was like being inundated with folks filtering down, as you can imagine.
And can imagine in a society like that, where there's all the pillaging and looting going on and the government has failed, you're probably going to try to get away from there, I guess.
Oh, yeah. So you know, many wanted to blame the Christians because Rome had fallen. They said that Rome had been strong when they were pagan, but seemed to become weak after becoming Christian. Now, that in response to this, Augustine wrote this famous work, The City of God. And he groups men in two categories, the mass of the godless and the company of spiritual men. The worldly city is united by the common love for temporal things, and the city of God is bound together by the love of God. Now, Bruce Shelley does a good job in summarizing all this. But Augustine writes, quote, the earthly city will not be everlasting, for when it is condemned to the final punishment, it will no longer be a city. We have learned that there is a city of God, and we have learned to become citizens of that city with a love inspired by its founder. Now, Augustine would point out that a civilization can fall without implicating or affecting the Christian church. Quote, the city of man cannot blame the city of God for its own decay, and the church may well prosper at the same time that other powers fail. This is no surprise to us to see the kingdoms of men rising and the kingdoms of men falling, because our commitment is not to eternal Rome. Our commitment is to Jesus Christ and exclusively to the kingdom he is building.
I can imagine pastors and churches having to say something similar today if they're in the United States. And if the United States were to fall,
yeah.
I can imagine similar things being asked and similar types of reasoning having to be employed there. So
I think we'd make a beeline to the City of God written by Augustine.
Yeah, probably should.
I think that would be, matter of fact, I probably, We probably need to start reading it.
Yeah.
We probably need to start reading it right now. But anyway, one more thing about Augustine, he struggled with the sexual desire. He believed that sin was a sexually transmitted defect and sex was inherently evil. He also believed that infant baptism, quote, purged primal sin and prepared someone for salvation.
Yeah, and, so I think there you're starting to see there's a lot of problems in Augustine's thought.
Him and Jerome. Jerome also had some kind of different thoughts about the sexual things. He just ran from it. And it's almost like they did not know how to have a sexual identity in this time and be close to the Lord in some ways.
And I think that wrong doctrine obviously impacted the church negatively over the centuries.
Well, you had all the priests going into celibacy. The celibacy was looked at as a higher calling.
Yeah, and that's so opposite to what the Bible teaches.
Yes.
So it's unfortunate that that philosophy got mixed in with Christianity.
So much is an overreaction to a bad thing.
Exactly.
Because it was such a sexually perverse time, and there's so much sexual promiscuity during that time to where, you know, there's such a reaction against that, a repulsing back from that, that it's an overreaction. And
I think you can find examples all throughout history of that type of thing going on.
Yeah.
Not just with sexual issues, but all sorts of different issues.
A reaction to reaction is an overreaction, and then you have to have another reaction to an overreaction.
End of side A.